Laura Marling, Hope in the Air. That song, by the way, is in the personal stash. The moment I heard it, the moment that it was done, and I it's a couple of years old. The moment I heard it, I had to throw it into the stash. I love it. Anyway, 7:33 the time. A very good, beautiful, absolutely perfect Laguna Beach morning, 27 minutes before 8 o'clock. If you, at some point today, get out and enjoy the sunshine. Just rub a little bit on your face there. I just rub a little of that sunshine on your face. We are all month long celebrating Black History Month. We're doing this by honoring and spotlighting some of the great artists, some great music, first of all. But we're also having very important conversations about what Black History Month means throughout the month. And these are, in some cases, maybe uncomfortable conversations for some members of the audience. But nonetheless, they're conversations that have to happen. And we're going to meet and introduce you to maybe some people that have contributed to the greatness that is athleticism in the Black community. That you may not know about. I swear, you know the stories of Jackie Robinson, who broke through the major league's color barrier in 1947. Absolutely outstanding feat, right? And a great athlete. We know about Jesse Owens, who ran roughshod over Adolf Hitler's notions of Aryan supremacy at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. And by the way, the Olympics start today. We'll talk about that as we move along as well. But you might even know about Jack Johnson. Jack Johnson was the boxing great, the heavyweight who unapologetically defied the Jim Crow norms of the early 20th century here in America. Got more heat than anything else for, can you imagine this, having a white wife? Imagine, that was just the tip of the iceberg for Jack Johnson. But the modern world right now is still catching on to the breathtaking accomplishments of a gentleman named Marshall Taylor. Everyone called him Major Taylor. So we'll, for the sake of conversation today, call him Marshall Major Taylor, the Black bicycle racing sensation who became a world champ a decade before Jack Johnson. 10 years before Jack Johnson was even on our map, Marshall Major Taylor was captivating a still segregated nation when that sport was reaching new heights in popularity. There's a book out called Major Taylor, The Extraordinary Career of a Champion Bicycle Rider. Oh, my God. And thumbing through it, it's an amazing story. Let me just give you some tiny highlights here. Taylor was born in November of 1878 in the rural outskirts of Indianapolis, Indiana. His father was a poor Civil War veteran, and very, very little is known about his mother. And as you go through the book, there's not a lot to find about his mom. When Taylor was about 8 years old, his father was hired as a coachman for a wealthy white family. They were named the Southards. Taylor quickly became best friends with their son, Dan, to the point where he was living with the family and enjoying access to tutoring and gifts. One of the gifts was a brand new bicycle. So the Southards then moved to Chicago when Marshall Major Taylor was about 13, abruptly pulling him back to a life of poverty at that point. He still had the bicycle, however, and after showing a bike store owner the tricks that he'd learned on it, he was hired to put on a show outside the bicycle store in a military uniform, giving rise to the nickname Major. See, that's how he got the nickname Major. So he soon fell under the apprenticeship of bicycle racer who had at that point turned manufacturer, Louis de Franklin Mungar, who gave the promising biker a place to stay while providing instruction on proper training and nutrition and everything you need to be a champion cyclist. In June of 1895, Mungar helped Taylor surreptitiously enter a 75-mile race that had promised a prize worth $300. It's a lot of cake in those days, man, I'm telling you. In a scene that would be repeated many times in the years to come, the white riders greeted the lone black entrant rudely and threatened him with physical harm, of course, only to see him speed away to victory. And this would happen over and over and over again. Taylor also notched up victories at a few follow-up races, but his opportunities for competition really remained limited. And he had better opportunities for himself and much friendlier environs for his protege. Mungar convinced Taylor to move with him to Massachusetts. And this happened later that year. Taylor then enjoyed a warmer, if not entirely welcoming, reception on the East Coast than he did back in Indiana. And the racing community was slightly more welcoming. In 1896, as he fell in with a black biking club and won several integrated events, he also returned to Indianapolis that summer and set official records in the 1 mile, the 5th mile races, and the half mile race that had just opened at Capital City Track, in which he was rewarded, by the way, for winning those things. He was rewarded with a ban from the premises. So he was too good for the competition. You got to be banned. And this is way before doping in bicycling, obviously. This guy was just better. So shortly after his 18th birthday, he turned in an unforgettable pro debut. He turned pro at the New York City's Madison Square Garden by beating the current and three-time sprinting champion, a guy by the name of Eddie Cannonball, in a 1 mile race. He also entered the main event in this grueling competition at the time, where contestants logged as many miles as possible over 6 days. And he managed to finish in 8th place despite suffering from exhaustion and obviously, you know, exhaustion-fueled hallucinations that come with it. He ended up being crowned 30 times as champion in cycling races, and for the entirety of his career, was the only black cycler, the only professional black cycling champion. And we really, I didn't know about him until I picked up this book. Unfortunately, the former champ struggled in retirement and he died penniless. It's a sad ending to the story. But although he retired as a rich man, it wasn't long before his fortunes had turned south. He lost a sizable chunk of money in a failed investment in a new and improved automobile tire at the time, and he struggled to find a reliable source of income. In 1929, he self-published his autobiography, The Fastest Bicycle Rider in the World, which, by the way, I just ordered. I haven't gotten it yet, but I ordered it. But by then, he was already estranged from his wife and his daughter, and he'd been forced to sell his house. Even worse than that, there wasn't much of a market for his book at the time. And as the glory days of American bike racing had already kind of faded at that point in the rearview mirror, he wasn't able to sell that book on cycling. He lived out his final days just as he came into the world, penniless, in a Chicago YMCA. He died in June of 1932 at the charity ward of the Cook County Hospital and was buried in an unmarked grave at Mount Glenwood Cemetery. Today, right now, by letting you know this, we're going to not let his legacy gather dust. In recent years, I didn't know, he's received a lot more notice for his achievements. I haven't noticed anyone, I haven't really noticed it, but he has received more notice for his achievements through bicycle clubs that are named in his honor and the dedication there. This is cool. A dedication of a statue in his adopted hometown of Worcester, Massachusetts. But we are remembering today Marshall Major Taylor, an athlete who had to go through a lot just to do what he loved and eventually was so good that he became a champion. Marshall Major Taylor. Remember that name.